morning. Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us, as always. And we have an interesting show today. We're going to be talking about the strange and wonderful world of Washington, D.C., life inside the Beltway, and how everything changes and nothing stays the same, and yet it does. Two interesting guests here, Katie Maddox from the Federal Managers Association. We're going to sort of do a legislative rundown, and then Jessica Clement from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees is going to join us later in the show for her take on some of these things. And Katie, I apologize in advance. We've known each other a long time, but I keep calling you Katie Perry, and that's because of the influence of my granddaughter. So it's well intended. Well, a funny thing happened overnight. We were facing, crisis number 796, the same old issues, mm-hmm. possibility of a shutdown, possibility of a problems because of the raising the debt ceiling limit, a variety of other things. And what happened?
So last night, leaders within the House and within the administration came together and announced this enormous budget deal that would fund the federal government for 2 years, also raise the debt ceiling and kind of just, put things together. It's probably one of the biggest, budget deals that we've seen in a long time. I know I heard speculation about it when the previous CR was passed, back in September, October. And I was honestly, my first reaction was like, how on earth are the House and Senate going to come together and figure out a 2-year budget deal? They can't agree on, an appropriations process. How are they going to do this? So it's really exciting that they've been able to come together and do this. And what's even more exciting is that they've increased spending both for domestic and military, and it doesn't affect federal workers. We're very excited that for once, federal workers aren't being used as a pay for.
Well, this seems to me to illustrate that the strangeness about Washington. Nothing happens for the entire mm-hmm. year. Nothing happens for 2 years. You have a shutdown and furloughs in 2013, 2014, like they never heard of them. And then, boom, it becomes a threat again this year. Mm-hmm. And the government was on the verge of a shutdown in early October, earlier this month. And then something that nobody counted on, Speaker John Boehner said, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And that defused the various factions in the Republican Party, gave the Democrats cause to, I think, say gulp. Mm-hmm. And then the unthinkable, this 2-year agreement happened. And what are is there a problem with it in the Senate? I mean, other than that they're surprised, maybe?
I think the main is, shock about it. I know the House is scheduled to vote on it today. The Senate will probably take it up tomorrow. I know there has been speculation from Senator Rand Paul that he's going to filibuster it over the debt ceiling. But, let's wait and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, this goes to show to me, no matter how long you've been here and how well you think you know how the process is going to go, these little things happen, such mm-hmm. as the very surprising resignation, early retirement yeah. of the speaker, this agreement. The White House, Bob Woodward had a front page story in the Washington Post a couple of years ago in which he said, everybody's talking about where did the sequestration come from? It came from the White House. Secretary Lew, now Treasury Secretary Lew, Jack Lew, and some others came up with this, took it down to the then Majority Leader, Senator Harry Reid, and they said, okay, this is, for whatever the purpose of it, it was a poison pill. Mm-hmm. It wasn't supposed to happen, and yet it did happen. One person created it, the other body, the House, let it happen, and then both were denouncing it and running away with it. And this is just the way Washington works.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we still have those sequestration cuts in effect. And like you said, everyone has denounced it. They said it's bad policy, but we're not really seeing that much action on it. So we'll see what happens if anything comes about.
Well, what I don't understand, and I think a lot of people maybe don't understand, is in 2013, sequestration was a very big deal. It was partially, if not fully responsible for the furloughs mm-hmm. that hit hundreds of thousands of people and cost some feds 20% of their income. FEA, the Federal Employees Education Assistance Fund, literally ran out of money, making no interest loans to people. It was that desperate a situation. And then later on, you had the shutdown, which, as you well know, went, what, 16 days?
16 days.
16 days. Nobody did any work unless they were in an emergency type job. National parks were closed. The government ceased functioning in many, many areas. And yet when it was all over, the Congress decided to pay these employees. So it, although it was a major inconvenience for some people, it amounted to a 16-day bonus paid vacation for them. And then again, it hasn't even been discussed this year.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go so far as to say it was a paid vacation. I mean, a lot of people were under stress about that. And I know there were a lot of op-eds in local newspapers here and also across the country of federal employees speaking out, I don't know if I want to stick with my federal career because it's being undermined this way.
Yeah.
And as you were mentioning with the sequestration furloughs, most of FMA's members are in the Department of Defense, which saw those furloughs. And they would only be required to work about 32 hours a week during those furloughs. And most of our members, they work 60-hour weeks just because of the nature of their jobs and what they have to get done on, you know, a weekly, daily basis. And I was getting emails from our members saying, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've never had to halt my work this way. And it was just such a cost to the mission and goals of DOD. The shutdown just undermined federal departments and agencies and what they were capable of doing. So I am very glad that, you know, we're going to avoid this problem again come December 11th with this budget.
Well, and of course, the IRS had the furloughs.
Oh, yes.
The Uncle Sam's biggest money maker, or at least money collector, and they had the furloughs. But it strikes me as how one year it's the rule. It's the thing du jour. And then the next year, it's not even mentioned. It's as if it never happened.
Which is unfortunate, because I think we need to keep that fresh in our mind of, you know, what can happen if we don't fully plan for this type of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've had some emails before, during, and after the furloughs and the shutdowns, and several people said, you know, everybody knows that you should have 6 months to 9 months to a year's cash set aside. We all know that. Very few of us can do it. But, you know, people want to have something. But I have had people who said they've set aside in a special account for of 2 weeks money so that they can turn a shutdown into a vacation.
But I also know a lot of our members, they live paycheck to paycheck, and it's just not possible.
Well, yeah, FEA showed that, the run on them, tens of thousands of people, and it was interesting how FEA handles it. I don't know if you know the procedure. They don't give you the money. You give them your landlord's name. You give them the power company's name and show them the bill, and then they make a check out to that particular person. So it's not... It's a loan to you, but it's not a loan to you.
Right.
It's a loan to your creditor.
Right. And like you were saying, they went through a lot of their capital just during that furlough and shutdown period. So, you know, they're making some gains, but I know they're really looking forward to the combined federal campaign this year.
Okay. So probably the threat of a shutdown is gone certainly for this year, maybe even for next year.
I know I was talking briefly with Congressman Whitman when there was just first speculation about this 2 year period. And he was commenting on, you know, we'll do this 2 year deal. After a year, we'll look at what our funding levels are, what is needed, what's, you know, not needed, and if there can be some movement, you know. So I think this is really going to be very interesting to look at. Of how do you budget the federal government this way? Because, I mean, you know, for the longest time, we've been going on very short terms. And I know a lot of states do two-year budget plans, and it would be very interesting to see how this will compare and how successful it will be.
Yeah, some even do five-year plans.
Yep.
I know that. You know, looking at the possibility of a shutdown or a furlough, earlier this year, a number of people, myself included, were saying we're probably going to have buyouts because of to get people out early in the fiscal year, and it sort of seemed to make sense. I have not heard of one. Have you?
I haven't heard of buyouts. I know just in instances like this, a lot of people start looking at, you know, am I eligible for retirement? You know, when can I leave? You know, when's, you know, what makes the most financial sense for me? But I haven't heard of any buyouts.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because the revealed truth to a lot of us was that they would have to have buyouts in order to save money and to be the most effective. You know, we just started the new fiscal year, October 1, in order to save the most money, you get people, particularly higher income people, out as soon as possible in the fiscal year. And yet here we are almost at the end of October and no sign of a... So once again, the pundits are wrong. We've got a couple of months left. Congress has spent an awful lot of time on vacation this year. They don't like to call it that. They call it a back home district work period, and there are all sorts of interesting names for it. But they haven't been here. They haven't been doing their job. They haven't passed budgets. They haven't done this. Then there's this last minute surge, which seems to happen. But there are new bills being introduced almost daily that would take a hit at federal workers.
I know we've, you know, always seen speculation of moving from the high three to the high five.
Yep, that's been around forever.
You know, making increases to those who are enrolled in FERS for their retirement. You know, we're also seeing speculation about, you know, making changes to federal health and benefit program. So, I mean, it's always going to be out there. And just because that these cuts aren't in the budget deal right now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to see them in the future.
Yeah, I want to ask you about a surprise after we take a break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Katie Maddox. She's with the Federal Managers Association. Katie, the FMA, your membership is primarily in the Defense Department, you said.
That's where we started out. We started in DOD, and about 60% of our members are in DOD. But then we're also in Social Security, IRS, EPA, U.S. Mint. We're in about 40 federal agencies and departments, and we're all across the country and overseas as well.
What is a federal manager? What GS levels are you talking about?
We refer to it as, you know, if you manage either people or a project, we represent your interests. A lot of our folks are frontline managers, so they're right there on the floor, you know, making sure that goals and missions get done. We only have about a handful of senior executives. But so it's mostly those, you know, GS-10 through GS-14 or so.
Okay, good enough. Now, before the break, we were talking about the fact that feds seem to be out of the woods in some respects for maybe as long as 2 years because of this new budget deal between the White House and the House. Still must go through the Senate, which is it's not a sure thing, not a done deal. And as you said, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who's a Republican presidential contender, has said he's threatened to possibly
filibuster
on this, which could slow it down, if not kill it. So feds may be out of the woods this year, next year, as far as furloughs and shutdowns because of the debt ceiling limit argument, the annual argument. So that's good news. That would be a nice thing to have off your radar. But there are bills pending, and as you mentioned before the break, I call them the usual suspects because they have been around forever, but they still scare federal employees. This, interestingly, the one you mentioned, switching from the retirement contribution from the employee's highest 3-year average salary to the employee's highest 5-year average salary, the high three to high five. A lot of people don't realize that it used to be the high five. It's only in fairly modern times that they changed it to the high three, but it's been on every shopping list, every member of Congress, every committee, every group that wants to save money in the government suggests this. It's never happened. It's not even come close, but it seems to be one thing that people fear tremendously, although there are other things out there that are, I would assume, much scarier. One of them is this proposal to make everybody under the Federal Employees Retirement System, FERS, pay the same amount of money toward their retirement. And I believe it would, you now have three tiers, I think.
Yeah, there's FERS, which, you know, was established in the mid-80s. And then there's FERS-RE, which was developed in a budget deal a couple of years ago. And it changes so that those hired after, I believe, December 31st, 2012, would contribute 3.1%. And then there's FERS-FRE, which would change contributions for those hired after December 31st, 2013, to 4.4%.
Right. So the bulk of the current FERS employees, who are the majority mm-hmm. of people working, are paying, what, 1.3%, something like that?
I think it's 1.7.
1.7, okay. The second tier is paying 3.1% of salary,
yes.
Considerable difference.
Yeah.
And the other is paying 4.4%.
Mm-hmm.
There's one bill out there that would take, they'd say, bring them all in. The only way to really save money is to go back and get the bulk of the people. So they would take everybody who is under the FERS system now, regardless of when you were hired, regardless of how long you've been on the job, and you would all wind up paying 4.4%.
Right.
There's what are the odds of something like that, particularly this time of year?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I haven't seen it on a markup schedule or anything like that currently. But I mean, it is a threat. When those who were first put onto FERS in the 80s, they're getting ready for retirement now. And if they are facing those changes to retirement, that is some substantial financial changes to them. And I am not sure if they have time to correctly adjust for it. And in addition, those who are facing, you know, even now with the 3.1 and the 4.4, the federal workforce is having a very, very difficult time with recruitment. And by having these increases to your retirement plan, they aren't doing anything to encourage younger people to join up. So I would really like to examine, what is this doing to recruitment and retention? Are people leaving early because of these threats of retirement? And are people even joining because of these lackluster benefits?
Well, I wonder, too, how aware or unaware federal workers are of life in the private sector. I mean, many of them worked in the private sector, but also many of them didn't. And you have a situation, one of the REI, mm-hmm. the big camping outdoor place, has decided that they're going to give their employees a paid holiday on Thanksgiving Day and a paid holiday the day after, so-called Black Friday. And they're saying, whether this is an advertising ploy or whatnot, they're saying, we're an outdoors company. We want to give our people a break. We're going to take the hit with the Black Friday shopping and the pre-Christmas shopping. But things are changing very rapidly in the private sector and the public sector, too. You know, in various states, they've changed or eliminated their pension plans,
mm-hmm.
Things that had been in place for 10, 20, 30 years. The Washington Post recently stopped its pension plan. So the new employees, they will have a 401k plan and Social Security, but no, there's no defined benefit or no benefit plan from the employer. Do you see, and I know every time you have a commission, such as the one President Obama appointed, they always recommend hits in the retirement program, reductions, mm-hmm. and they show these tremendous savings over 10 years. Do you think that's the next assault on federal workers?
I mean, I think it has been an assault on federal workers for a good long while. But just because it's being done in the private sector, does that automatically mean that it's going to happen in the public sector? I don't know. I don't think so. And I'd also like to say, you know, good on REI for doing that. But
yeah.
I think that it's a totally different workforce between a private sector, you know, retailer, which probably I'm going to assume that most of their workforce, maybe college graduates, maybe high school graduates, whereas in the federal workforce, you have at least you know, most people have at least a college, degree. A lot of people have, you know, even graduate degrees as well. It's a totally different characteristics between the two. So I think it's really hard to compare the two sectors.
Yeah, comparing is dangerous.
It is.
As I always say, Uncle Sam doesn't do retail. There are no greeters. And when you walk into a federal building, there isn't a guy in a red vest that greets you. But that said, understanding the big differences and whatnot, you have politicians and you have people. For instance, when people say if federal workers will quit and get another job, but if it's so bad in the private sector, their argument is, where are they going to go?
Yeah. And I think you do see that a lot. I know we have members who have gone back and forth between private and public. And it really is just a different animal out there in the private sector. So I'm really not sure. I know a lot of our members, they're dedicated to their jobs. They like serving their communities and their nation. And that's really why they stick around.
Okay. Need to take a short break here. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome to your turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us. And a reminder that we are booked on our homepage, so you can listen to this show or any other Your Turn show or any other show on Federal News Radio by going to our homepage. And these are particularly interesting when you have financial planning things and retirement planning. My guest is Katie Maddox from the Federal Managers Association. We're talking about how one of the Halloween boogie monsters disappeared almost overnight with this new two-year budget deal, assuming the Senate buys into it. Katie, you guys had a particular victory. Was it today? Yesterday?
It was Monday night, Tuesday morning. I think I got the word Monday night.
This is the Wounded Warriors?
The Wounded Warriors Federal Leave Act.
Not to be confused with the Wounded Warriors charity.
They do excellent work, but this is a little different.
Okay, what is your Wounded Warriors Act?
Basically, what it does is it provides 104 hours of sick leave to first-year federal employees who qualify under the Department of Veteran Affairs as 30% disabled or more. And this extra sick leave is to be used to go see their, you know, VA doctors, their VA nurses, and get medically necessary treatments for their service-related injuries. Basically, it's a homegrown initiative from one of our chapters in Cherry Point, North Carolina, at the Marine Corps Air Station. One of our members, Sue Thatch, great woman, and she noticed one of her employees was really struggling to still keep up with his doctor's appointments and also do his job at the air station. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Cherry Point, but, you know, it's about 3 hours to get to the nearest VA hospital. And he would have to take off a whole day, you know, to go see his doctor. And when you're in that first year of your federal service, you come in with a zero-sum sick leave balance.
Sure, and that's the probation year, too,
yep.
Right?
And so he was really struggling and just burning through hours. I think he used 30 hours within, you know, the first 3 months of the year. So if he kept up that pace, it would have been 120 hours in his first year, which he can't even earn. So this, you know, this bill, it does a lot of good. And we are so excited that it passed, you know, the House and the Senate. And, you know, it's just waiting for the president's signature.
Okay, so that will give them 104 hours in their first year of federal employment.
Yeah.
And that's really a big deal because the federal government, I believe now, obviously it would be the largest, but I think it's also one of the best in terms of percentage as an employer mm-hmm. of veterans, correct?
Yeah.
Is that right?
It is. Largest employer. And, you know, we were going through the numbers with this, and only about 6% of the federal workforce is, you know, a newly hired and 30% disabled. So it's not going to affect a lot of people, but those who it does affect, it's going to be great for them. And we are so glad that we were able to work with Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts and Senator John Tester of Montana. And they have just been great, and they really championed this issue. And we're just so grateful that it passed.
Yeah, okay. And this is this I guess is a no-brainer. The White House will certainly sign it.
I have not heard that they're not going to sign it, but I mean, Representative Micah, during its first markup in the last Congress, he said, "This is common sense."
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to do
not
a lot
a partisan issue, obviously.
It's not.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those ironies of life is that the medical care, the battlefield medical care, is so much better now than it ever has been. Tragic as the events are, and so people who went in past wars would have just died. They're on the spot. They are sometimes in a matter of hours. They're in Germany getting some of the best medical treatment in the world, but those wounds are forever. You know, mm-hmm. if you lose an arm, lose a leg. Post-traumatic stress can last a lifetime.
It can, and we just want to make sure that these people are getting, you know, all the care that they deserve and they need.
Okay. Now, when you and a legislative department such as FMA's has, you've got to constantly be have the radar on and looking around.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this 2-year budget agreement, at least approved by the White House and the House.
Mm-hmm.
Senate still up for grabs, but it's looking good, presumably. Some of these things are going on. What are you guys looking at now? What are you doing? What are people in the federal community doing? And what should rank and file feds be doing?
Well, what one legislative issue that we're really excited about is the Competitive Service Act. As I mentioned before, recruitment is an issue within the federal workforce. I know a lot of people have said just the application process is quite burdensome and, you know, it's, you know, a maze to get through. And what the Competitive Service Act is, it takes the best qualified list from one application and it shares that information. So you don't have to go through the process multiple times to apply to the same position, whether it be in IRS, Social Security, EPA, what have you. And it's passed the Senate. It's been marked up in the House, and we're waiting for a full House vote on it, and we're very excited about that.
When he was chairman of the House Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin, was very active in looking for ways to save money mm-hmm. and very active in looking at the federal portion of government. Now he's going to be speaker, presumably. There's been some speculation, some written in various trade papers and local papers, that when Ryan comes into office, federal workers are really in trouble because as Speaker of the House, he'll have this tremendous power, more so than in the Budget Committee, and he'll be able to force at least the House to implement these changes. I would think maybe almost the opposite, that because he's made a guarantor of the job, that he wants to keep his what little family time he has. Family lives in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. remains there, but he still wants weekends off. Well, understandably so, commendable. Wish somebody had done it before, but I would think that he's going to be so busy running the House, or at least the majority in the House, that he would be too busy to get down in the weeds with these little projects to cut federal benefits. What do you think?
You know, it's going to be interesting to look at what he proposes. Like you said earlier, with the usual suspects, I think we are going to see that again. I think we're going to see threats of it, but I don't know how realistic those threats are going to be and how fervish he is going to be about it.
Yeah, okay.
So we'll see.
Okay, so what's coming up? Almost the end of October, what's coming up?
You know, we just got to keep our eye on that budget and what's going to happen with that. Like you said, we don't know if the Senate's going to happen, is going to approve it or not. But, you know, that's what's on our minds right now.
Okay, and do you know, I gather a lot of people don't know really exactly what's in that budget.
We have seen vague descriptions of it, and, you know, basically it's just we're happy that it doesn't touch feds. It makes sure that Medicare Part B premiums aren't going to rise. I know that was a threat, and I know Democrats are incredibly happy that that wasn't included in there, or that making sure that those cuts weren't going to take into effect was included in there. And then also there are going to be some changes to Social Security as well. They're not going to be immediate changes, but it's what Republicans asked for. So this looks like a nice compromise bill.
Yeah. If you were talking to a young friend going into college or just coming out, looking around for employment, would you still recommend the government?
I would. You can do a lot of good in the federal government. It's a great opportunity to really expand your knowledge on very set skills, and you're serving your community.
The thing that just always fascinates me about the government is it's into everything, and
yeah,
it covers the waterfront. I was talking to a guy this morning with the Bureau of Land Management, and I don't want to tell his job because it would identify him, but some really interesting stuff. And you know, the Interior Department does all of these great things. The Agriculture Department has foreign operations. NASA, you can only imagine. But it there's just so many opportunities to not only do good, you know, we all say that, but to maybe have a little fun in the
yeah.
process.
I have a friend who is a social worker for occupational health.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who is studying erosion and trees in the Agriculture Department. And you can do just about anything. It's not, you know, clerical jobs that, you know, once were considered the primary bulk of federal employment. You can do a lot of different things.
I knew someone who worked for an agency where they gave payments to people over of a certain age. And one of her jobs was to go around and visit these elderly people. And I thought, well, that's sweet. You know, mm-hmm. they're checking to see if they're doing all right. And he said, that's one of the reasons. The other is to make sure they're still alive.
Yeah.
And they're not, you know, an uncle or a landlord or something like that isn't collecting their checks. But whatever you want to do, the government is the place to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. We had a very good session with Katie Maddox of the Federal Managers Association. Now we're going to be talking to a colleague in arms of hers, Jessica Clement, with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Jesse, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me. Hey,
thank you. And Katie said to tell you hello. I guess you two talked yesterday about some legislative matters. But...
See each other all the time.
Okay, good enough. Good enough. Hey, listen, a couple of things going on, but wanted to ask you about the victory on the Medicare Part B.
That's great. I would love to talk about the victory on the Medicare Part B.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal. I wish more people would realize how hard this fight was to win. So basically, it's long and complicated,
yeah.
right? It's not something you can describe in two, three, even seven sentences. I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Medicare Part B premiums were set to increase next year regardless, right? But when you don't have a COLA, Social Security recipients are held harmless from any increase in their Medicare premiums. But that hold harmless provision doesn't extend to anyone. And the administration was interpreting the law to mean that when the hold harmless provision is enacted, the remaining beneficiaries not held harmless have to shoulder the full cost of the increase. So premiums were set to go from about $105 a month to $120. With hold harmless, those 30% of individuals who are not held harmless were going to have to pay, instead of the $105, $159. I mean, they were facing almost a $55 a month increase in their Medicare premiums. We've been sounding the alarm bells on this issue since July when the Medicare trustees report came out, had August meetings with everyone in leadership trying to gain attention to this issue so when Congress came back in September, we could run mm-hmm. with a fix. This did happen in 2010 and 2011, but to a much, much smaller extent. I believe the increase in premiums was less than $10. A month for those not held harmless. Now we're facing a much larger scale. The bigger the premium increase, the bigger the cost is to Congress to fix this.
So $59 a month is a lot. It's a break the bank issue for a lot.
I mean,
of
it's almost $700 a year to individuals living on a fixed income. This, you're absolutely right. It's probably the choice between, you know, food
yeah.
and paying your Medicare premium. So this is absolutely a big deal. We saw legislation introduced in October to fix this. It's been a priority of several in-house leadership to fix. So the compromise in the budget was this. Premiums were set to increase into $120.70 per month anyway. So those not held harmless, which for a lot of people, it's anyone who doesn't pay their Medicare premiums out of their Social Security check. So a lot of CSRS retirees who don't receive Social Security. Their premiums in 2016 will go to what they would have otherwise, that 120.70 instead of 159.30. So I'm hearing from a lot of upset individuals that why aren't they held harmless like everybody else? And that's certainly a long-term fix that NARF is going to work on, because this situation shouldn't happen. It shouldn't matter how you pay your premiums, from what check you pay your premiums. You know, at the end of the day, you shouldn't have to. It's unfair that you pay more just because you don't collect a Social Security check. But I think based on both the fiscal and political environments we are facing on Capitol Hill, this is, while imperfect, an accepted compromise for us. We consider it a victory.
Yeah, $20 is better than $59.
And $15 is certainly better than $55,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and they would have increased that much anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I know your boss, Richard Thiessen, the president of NARF, is concerned about this thing we mentioned in the column this morning, the Retail Investment Act. And it sounds harmless to me. What's the problem?
It does. Isn't that the most deceptively named bill you've
ever
heard?
I'd vote for it, yeah.
All right, exactly. So it's best to describe this issue by using examples, because, again, it's very wonky, and it's very technical in terms of how you can describe it using a lot of investment terms. So I'm going to do it by example just for ease. So you're a TSP participant, right? You're about to retire, and you're saying to yourself, I don't know what to do with my TSP accounts. So you pick up the phone, and you call Charles Schwab. Charles Schwab, per the current definition of advice that they can give based on rollovers, Charles Schwab, and I this is nothing against Charles Schwab, just using them as an example, can say to you, oh, your money's in the TSP. If you come with us, I can invest your money in an S&P 500 fund and guarantee you a rate of return of 7%. And you aren't sure where your TSP money is. You right now cannot get investment advice from the TSP board, something that they are working on. And your HR office may be outsourced, or you may not even have one in your building. And you're thinking, yeah, S&P 500 fund at 7%, that sounds great. Not knowing that your money in the TSP is probably already in that S&P 500
fund. Sure, if it's
fund,
a C fund.
Getting the 7% for a much, much lower administrative fee that you're going to get with one of the carriers. And financial advisors can do this because it meets a suitability standard. It's suitable advice they can give you on your rollover. Now, the DOL, Department of Labor, proposed a rule earlier in the summer that would hold advice on rollovers to the best interest standard or fiduciary standard, in which case that advisor would have to say would have to act in their client's or potential client's best interest. In which case, they'd say your money is better off in the TSP because it has much lower administrative fees than you would get with us. I think this is one of the reasons why 50% of people who separate from government within a year remove all their TSP funds. That is an alarming statistic for the Thrift Board. It's certainly alarming for NARF as well, and I think this is one of the reasons why.
You know, that's so interesting, because it's a huge bundle of money. Outside financial people look at it with great envy. It's the biggest 401k in the country. It's done automatically withdrawn from people's accounts. As you said, the administrative fees are the lowest in the business. I think they're half, again, what Vanguard's fees are, and Vanguard is the lowest in the mutual fund business. And we had John Bogle on this show a couple of years back. He's the founder of Vanguard and the godfather of the index fund. And he said that these administrative fees are something he wanted to tackle as a private individual, because over time they can really eat into your earnings. You know, all things being equal, if you have money in the C fund, the S&P 500 versus a mutual fund outside of the thrift savings plan, over time, the person in the TSP will make a lot more money because they won't have those fees to pay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you just summed it up Perfectly. So the bill on the floor yesterday, which did pass, mostly party line vote, two Republicans voted against, three Democrats voted for, would essentially, and it's not totally clear how it's written, but it would essentially delay and then ultimately block the Department of Labor from implementing this rule. The Financial Services Committee on the House has been intent on doing this since the rule was proposed. I would expect we'd see a rider to this effect in any appropriations bill that comes as a result of that budget agreement that the House is set to pass today. So this issue isn't going to, I mean, the House passed this bill. I don't think they'll take it up in the Senate, but that's not the end all be all of this. They'll try to make sure DOL stops this in any piece of legislation they can.
Well, you know, with the budget compromise, it looks like feds can rest a little easier than they could a couple of days ago. But thank you very much, Jesse, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next Wednesday, same time, same station. Have a good week.